The last three sermons now, I've been giving some sermons on the Exodus. And so far, we have looked at certain key things. Some of the important things we covered is where was the crossing? And we don't know. And where was the mountain of God? We don't know. So we don't know much, do we? But we did look at some theories. You know, there's a popular theory that the crossing was up here in these lakes, not even crossing the Red Sea. There's another theory that the crossing was up here near the tip of the Gulf of Suez. Some like the crossing down here at the mouth of the Gulf of Aqaba. Others like the crossing up in here somewhere, like at Nueva Beach, which is a big beach. And there's others. I didn't mention all of them. Like there's one where this apparently thousands of years ago used to be some shallow lakes up in this area. So some people think that that's where the crossing was. And, you know, the two most popular areas for the Mountain of God is in the South Sinai and over here in Midian. But there's some people who think it's way up here near the Dead Sea at Mount Or. Now, so there's lots of theories there, and we kind of looked at from the viewpoint of what's the most, seems to have the most support from the Bible. And it kind of sounds like that the Midian area somewhere might well be where the Mountain of God is, but we don't know for sure. And this, in that sense, it's not so important that we do know, but it is interesting to speculate on it. So I'm going to continue on with the path of the children of Israel as they came out of of Egypt. And so this will be the fourth sermon I've given on this, and titled The Miracle of the Exodus. And I want to begin, we've gotten the Israelites through the Red Sea and up to the Mountain of God, wherever that might be. Excuse me. So we've got them that far. And I want to pick up where we left off last time. As you recall last time, it kind of looked like once they got there to the Mountain of God, it appears that they arrived 3 or 4 days before the Ten Commandments were given, which we believe was on Pentecost. And Moses got busy very quickly, going up and down the mountain, up and down the mountain. He went up and down the mountain probably three times, just from what we read. It doesn't say specifically. But then those ups and downs, God said, okay, I'm going to speak to everybody on the third day from the time that Moses was up there. And so we'll pick up in Exodus 19, verses 16 through 19, where it is that third day, and again, which we believe is Pentecost. And then it came to pass on the third day in the morning that there was thunderings and lightnings with a thick cloud on the mountain, and the sound of the trumpet was very loud, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled. And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. And now Mount Sinai, you know, and we'll use the Bible term Sinai, which we're referring to the Mountain of God, wherever it was. Now, Mount Sinai was completely in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire. His smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked greatly. And when the blast of the trumpet sounded long and became louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him by voice. So they're there at the base of the mountain. Moses is kind of there in front. And it looks like the end of the world probably to the Israelites at that time. Now, one thing about these accounts of the journeys of the Israelites is that there's more than one account. Deuteronomy gives a parallel account where Moses is talking to the Israelites just before they do enter Canaan and relating all the things that happened during those past 40 years. And then in Numbers, there's a certain part of the book of Numbers that also encounters some of their travels and some of the things that happened during this time. And so putting these things all together can be kind of confusing. The Bible doesn't necessarily give everything in historical sequence. Sometimes the Bible will take a certain event and carry it through in explaining everything to its end, where it may have started in month 2 and ended in month 7. And a lot of things happened in between when that's covered in other sections of the Bible. But for example, here is the parallel account in Deuteronomy, verse 4, verses 11 and 12. Then you came near and stood at the foot of the mountain, and the mountain burned with fire in to the midst of the heavens with darkness, cloud, and thick darkness. So Deuteronomy doesn't make it sound quite as dramatic as it did in Exodus, but it must have been a sight to see. And then at this point, an incident occurred. And this is the prelude to the Ten Commandments. Moses takes another trip up the mountain. This is his fourth trip that we know of. At least that's what I think from where we've gotten up to this point. He may have made a lot more trips up the mountain that weren't mentioned in the Bible, but I'll be kind of listing the ones that we know about. So it's Exodus 19, verses 20 through 25. And we're just continuing on here in what we just read. Then the Lord came down upon Mount Sinai on the top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. So he's down there with the gang, and God calls him up. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go down and warn the people, lest they break through to gaze at the Lord, and many of them will perish. Also let the priests who come near the Lord consecrate themselves, lest the Lord break out against them." All right, so God said, hey, go back down and tell these people to stay back. And look at Moses' response here. But Moses said to the Lord, "The people cannot come up to Mount Sinai, for you warned us, saying, set bounds around the mountains and consecrate it." So Moses, no sweat, I've taken care of it. And look at God's response here. Then the Lord said to him, "Scat. Get away. Away with you," he said. "Get down and then come up, you and Aaron with you. But do not let the priest and the people break through to come up to the Lord, lest he break out against them." So Moses went down to the people and spoke to them. So God saw what some people were thinking. Moses saw, hey, I told them not to come up. They're going to obey me. Surely they've learned their lesson by this time. Well, God saw that they had not learned their lesson. And so there was still a problem there. Now, let's continue on here. In a parallel account in Deuteronomy 5, verses 4 and 5, the Lord talked with you face to face on the mountain from the midst of the fire. I stood between the Lord and you at that time to declare to you the word of the Lord, for you were afraid because of the fire, and you did not go up the mountain, he said. Okay, and so then after saying this, Moses says, he said, referring to God, and repeated the Ten Commandments in Deuteronomy 5. So he gave the Ten Commandments at this point. And in Exodus 20, verse 1, then that's where the commandments start. Immediately following this little incident, and God spoke all these words, saying, and gave the Ten Commandments. Now, I'm not going to put all the Ten Commandments up here, but this is when he gave them. And, you know, Israel basically agreed, even before hearing all the terms. Look at Exodus 20, verses 18 through 21. Now, this is after the Ten Commandments. Now all the people witnessed the thunderings, the lightnings, the flashes, the sound of the trumpets, and the mountains smoking. And when the people saw it, they trembled and stood afar off. Then they said to Moses, "You speak with us, and we will hear. But let not God speak with us, lest we die." And Moses said to the people, "Do not fear, for God has come to test you, and that His fear may be before you, so that you may not sin. All right, so you see the attitude there. We don't want to die. You go up there and take your chances. That's kind of the attitude that they had there. But Moses said something interesting here. He said, don't fear, for God has come to test you. He said, this is a test. This is a test. Because he doesn't want you to sin. Now, you know, God does test us from time to time. Let's look over in Deuteronomy 13, verses 1 through 3. Now, this is not the same occasion, but this is where he uses another example of testing. In Deuteronomy 13, verses 1 through 3, if there arises among you a prophet or a dreamer of dreams, and he gives you a sign or a wonder, and the sign or wonder comes to pass, of which he spoke to you, saying, let us go after other gods, which you have not known, and let us serve them, you shall not listen to the words of that prophet or the dreamer of dreams. So he's saying, look, the miracle is not the thing. It's the truth that the individual speaks. He says, continue on, for the Lord your God is testing you to know whether you love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. And so this idea of being tested is kind of new to these people. You know, they've never looked at God that way exactly. And so Moses is explaining to him that, you know, the testing is, what are you going to obey or not? That's the testing. The fear is the warning, you know, that the the test will, you know, the test itself, the miracle in many cases, is not the thing, but whether they're speaking the truth or not. You know, so what are you really looking at is basically what God's trying to get across through Moses. All right, then Deuteronomy 5, verses 22 through 27. Again, this is a parallel account. These words the Lord spoke to all of these your assembly in the mountain from the midst of the fire, the cloud, and the thick darkness with a loud voice, and he added no more. And he wrote them on two tablets of stone and gave them to me. So it was when you heard the voice from the midst of the darkness while the mountains were burning with fire that you came near to me, all of the heads of your tribes and your elders, and you said, surely the Lord our God has shown us his glory and his greatness, and we have heard his voice from the midst of the fire. We have seen this day that God speaks with man, yet still lives. Now, therefore, why should we die? So here's the parallel account of that same incident. For this great fire will consume us if we hear the voice of the Lord our God anymore. Then we shall die. For who is there of all flesh who has heard the voice of the living God speaking from the midst of the fire as we have and lived? You go near and hear all that the Lord our God may say, and tell us what he says. Tell us all that the Lord our God says to you, and we will hear it and we will do it. So here they're making kind of an agreement to the whole deal here, right from the beginning. The idea is, we just need you to take care of this because this is really scary. Then Deuteronomy 5:28 through 30, his fifth trip up the mountain. So now he's going back up the mountain to talk to God. And here is something very unusual. Matter of fact, this may be unique in the history of Israel. Deuteronomy 5:28-30. Then the Lord heard the voice of your words when you spoke to me, and the Lord said to me, I have heard the voice of the words of this people which they have spoken to you. They are right in all they have spoken. When did God ever say to the Israelites that they were right in all they had spoken? This may be the only time, either written or unwritten, that that happened. But then he says, oh, that they had such a heart in them that they would fear me and always keep all my commandments, that it might be well with them, with their children forever. Go and say to them, return to your tents. Okay, so he says, it's a deal. He said, they're finally right about something. They can't handle this. So go to your tents. Moses, you'll be the representative, and we'll work this thing out. So Moses is going up and down the mountain, acting as an intermediary here. Then Exodus 20:21, so the people stood afar off, but Moses drew near the thick cloud where God was. So he's continued to make trips. Then Deuteronomy 5:31-33, says, for you, stand here by me, and I will speak to you all the commandments, the statutes, the judgments, which you shall teach them, that they may be observed, they may observe them in the land which I'm going to possess, which I'm giving them to possess. Therefore, you shall be careful to do as the Lord your God has commanded you. You shall not turn aside to the right hand or the left. You shall walk in all the ways which the Lord your God has commanded, that you may live, and that it may be well with you, and that you may prolong your days in the land in which you possess. Now, notice these special promises. He says, well, you're going to survive the journey to Canaan. If you make this deal, if you accept the laws and obey them, you'll survive the journey. It'll be well with you on top of that. And your life will be long in the promised land. And of course, he's not talking about just those people, but the generations to come. But obviously, it didn't work. There was only a couple people whose life was long in the promised land. Basically Joshua and Caleb. But that was the deal that God held out to them. All right, so now Moses is up in the mountain and he's receiving his first set of instructions. I don't want to take the time to go through all the scriptures, but just outline it here. And what we're looking at is Exodus 20, verses 22 through Exodus 23, verse 33. So we're talking about a little more than a chapter here. And it starts out in Exodus 20:22. Then the Lord said to Moses, and he gives it's kind of interesting when you read through these. These don't seem all that general, really. He talks about the altar for the sacrifices in Exodus 20:22-36. He talks about betrothals, engagements, basically, not what we call it today, in Exodus 21:7-11. Acts of violence. Crimes against each other. He talks about dealing with that in Exodus 21:12-32. Livestock responsibility is in the idea here of when livestock, a bull, gore somebody, injure somebody, things of that nature in Exodus 21:33-36. Theft of property, Exodus 22:1-15. Conduct with people and God, an inner relationship with each other and God, Exodus 22:16-31. Just behavior, Exodus 23:1-9. Sabbath day and Sabbath year in Exodus 23:10-13. And the holy days, Exodus 23:14-19. Then following the angel of God, because the angel of God, the cloud, is going to be guiding them. The messenger of God would probably have been a better translation there. Exodus 23:20-24. And then he talks about the blessings of obedience during the conquest. And that's in Exodus 23:25-33, but let's just list them. It says he'll bless your bread and water. He'll take away your sickness. No miscarriages, no infertility, long life, confusion and fear to your enemies. So then send hornets to drive out your enemies. In other words, he's going to fight the battle for you. Will obtain the land promised to Abraham little by little. He's not going to get it all at once. And so all these blessings come with a couple of specific warnings here in Exodus 23:32-33. No covenants with the enemies, or with gods. In other words, no covenants. Stay away from all that. And the other one is to drive them all out of the land, or they will make you sin and be a snare. So he said, you need to clean house. Of course, we know what happened. And they didn't. They didn't keep their part of the deal. All right, so at this point, God sends Moses back down the mountain to the people. And this is the second confirmation of the covenant in Exodus 24, verses 3 through 8. Let's look at that. So Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all his judgments, and all the people answered with one voice and said, "All the words which the Lord has said, we will do." And Moses wrote all the words of the Lord, and he rose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel, and he sent the young men of the children of Israel who offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen to the Lord. And Moses took half the blood and put it in a basin, and half the blood he sprinkled on the altar. Then he took the blood of the covenant, book of the covenant, and read in the hearing of all the people. And they said, "All that the Lord has said, we will do, and be obedient." And Moses took the blood and sprinkled it over the people and said, "This is the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you according to all these words." And so here they confirmed the covenant for a second time. They confirmed it earlier, we saw from last sermon. All right, then we come to Exodus 24, verses 1 and 2. Moses goes up the mountain again. Now he said to Moses, "Come up to the Lord, you and Aaron and Nadab and Abihu and 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship him afar. And Moses alone shall come near the Lord, but they shall not come near, nor shall the people go up with them." All right, so now he's bringing the leadership core up the mountain. Now, this is very interesting from the perspective that what God is doing here, few humans have ever done or seen what God is about to reveal here. Very few. Exodus 24, 9 through 11. Then Moses went up, also Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and 70 elders of Israel, and they saw the God of Israel. And there was under his feet, as it were, a paved work of sapphire stone, and it was like the very heavens in its clarity. But on the nobles of the children of Israel, he did not lay his hand, so they saw God, and they ate and drank. Now, I wish they had described it more. About the only thing they're saying here is that they saw God, and basically, he was standing on this, what looked like a sapphire stone. Now, does that ring a bell? Well, how about Ezekiel and his vision? Ezekiel 1, verse 26. And above the firmament, this is when the winged creatures that were moving the throne of God around, and Ezekiel gave us a lot more information. Now, maybe there weren't any winged creatures over here in Exodus. Maybe they just saw the throne. But Ezekiel 1, 26, and above the firmament over their heads was the likeness of a throne, and an appearance like a sapphire stone. On the likeness of the throne was a likeness with the appearance of a man high above it. And so it sounds like maybe a very similar vision. Now, John 1:18 says no one has seen God. So this must have been a vision. But it's from the little bit of description we have, it's very similar, sounds like, to what Ezekiel saw. And very few have had the opportunity to even see that kind of vision of God. So then Exodus 24, verses 12 through 13. Now this is his seventh trip up the mountain. Then the Lord said to Moses, Come up to me on the mountain and be there, and I will give you tables of stone and the law and the commandments which I have written, that you may teach them. So Moses arose with his assistant Joshua, and Moses went up to the mountain of God. Okay, so he goes up and gets the instructions. After the elders, and so if they saw what was happening, and they went back down. Moses and Joshua go up. The next is 24, verses 16 through 18. Now the glory of the Lord rested on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days. And on the seventh day, he called to Moses out of the midst of the cloud. The sight of the glory of the Lord was like a consuming fire on the top of the mountain and in the eyes of the children of Israel. So Moses went into the midst of the cloud and went up to the mountain. And Moses was on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. So now he's going up the mountain to get the commandments. He describes, Moses describes this in Deuteronomy 9:9. And when I went up into the mountain to receive the tablets of stone, the tablets of the covenant which the Lord made, of the covenant that the Lord made with you, then I stayed on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights, in which I neither ate bread nor drank water. So the 40 days and nights of complete fasting, which is a miracle in itself. Obviously, God had to sustain him in some way for him to even survive for 40 days and 40 nights. All right, so, and notice he made him wait 6 days. He wanted to really get hungry before they got down to the real business. You know, he had to wait 6 days and went on up. And then so we come to Exodus 31, verses 16 and 17. The last thing he said at this time was the Sabbath of this visit up the mountain was the Sabbath covenant. Therefore, the children of Israel shall keep the Sabbath to observe the Sabbath throughout all the generations as a perpetual covenant. It is a sign between me and the children of Israel forever. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, and on the seventh day they rested and were refreshed. All right, so this ended, this visit up the mountain ended with the covenant, the Sabbath covenant. And then what happens next? The golden calf incident. You know, we're really at a turning point in history here. He comes back down the mountain. You know, Exodus 32, verses 9 and 10, the Lord said to Moses, I have seen this people. Indeed, it is a stiff-necked people. Now, therefore, let me alone that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may just consume them, and I will make of you a great nation. So this is, he comes down, breaks the tablets. A lot of people get killed as a result of this. And God is saying, all right, I give up. Let's start over. So what happened? Exodus 32, verse 28. So the sons of Levi did according to the word of Moses, and about 3,000 people, 3,000 men of the people fell that day. They were run through with the sword or spear at that time. So now remember we talked about this, probably at least somewhere around 2.5 million people there. And this was 3,000. So this sounds like maybe the ones that were killed were the ringleaders, the ones that were the rebel rousers, the ones that had probably been causing problems since they left Egypt. And so, but this, see, the Israelites had seen a lot of people die, but it basically wasn't them. No, it was Egyptians and enemies, the Amalekites and so forth. All of a sudden, they say, whoa, this God can kill us too. And you kind of sense after this point a change in attitude of the people. The fear became more real at this point. And they were very nervous from this point on. And God was not too happy about the whole situation himself, so they had a good reason to fear. You know, Aaron kind of helped out in that golden calf thing, so he was tested and failed. But then Moses was tested here, and you know, Moses passed the test. And then Exodus 32, verses 30 and 31, eighth trip up the mountain. So back up the mountain he goes after the golden calf fiasco. And it came to pass on the next day that Moses said to the people, "You have committed a great sin, so now I will go up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make an atonement for you." Now, in all this, Moses said, "I've got to go talk to God, or else you are in big trouble." So he goes up there. Deuteronomy 9:18 describes it this way: "And I fell down before the Lord, as at the first, 40 days and 40 nights, I neither ate bread nor drank water because of all your sin, which you committed in doing wickedly in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger." Another 40 days and nights of fasting. He had just finished this great fast. Now he goes up, does it again. Now that's dedication. Exodus 32, verses 31 to 33. "Then Moses returned to the Lord and said, 'Oh, these people have committed a great sin and have made for themselves a god of gold. Yet now, if you will forgive their sin, but if not, I pray, blot me out of the book which you have written.'" So he says, "Take me. Take me instead. Let me be the sacrifice." And then the Lord said to Moses, "Whoever has sinned against me, I will blot him out of my book." Now, God is making a point here. He's saying there's only one individual that can make that kind of sacrifice, Moses, and it's not you. You can only be the Son of God. He didn't say that, but we get the first hint of a Savior here, when Moses was rejected as being that savior of the people, you might say, at that time. That's the first hint of the unpardonable sin. If you're not going to stay committed to God, if you continually reject God, when you know and see what, in this case, these Israelites saw, you may be in big trouble. So it's a big message for us. All right, so let's continue on here. Exodus 33, verses 7 through 11. So the things kind of settle down here. You know, God, okay, we're not going to destroy everybody. Moses, you know, had a very frank conversation, and he spent 40 days fasting as part of that. And then in Exodus 33, verse 7 through 11, Moses took his tent, pitched it outside the camp, far from the camp, and called it the Tabernacle of Meeting. See, he goes out, he pitches a tent way out away from the camp. Almost sounds like, boy, I need to get away from these people myself. But it came to pass that everyone who sought the Lord went out to the Tabernacle of Meeting, which was on the outside, was outside the camp. Now, this wasn't the tabernacle, you know, with the ark and all that kind of stuff. This was just a tent that was pitched out there at this time. "And so it was, whenever Moses went out to the tabernacle, that all the people rose, and each man stood at his tent door and watched Moses until he'd gone into the tabernacle." Now, why would they do that? Were they maybe afraid that this is it? The end has come? They seemed very nervous at this stage, the way it's described here. "And it came to pass that Moses entered the tabernacle," when Moses entered the tabernacle, "that the pillar of cloud descended and stood at the door of the tabernacle, and the Lord talked with Moses. All the people saw the pillar of the cloud standing at the tabernacle door, and all the people rose and worshipped, and each man at his front door. So the Lord spoke to Moses face to face, as a man speaks to his friend, and he returned to the camp, but his servant Joshua, the son of Nun, a young man, did not depart from the tabernacle." So this was the temporary tabernacle. This was God's meeting place. Clearly what happened, Moses said, "I'm 80 years old. I can't keep climbing this mountain. Can we have another arrangement here?" Well, I don't know whether he said that or not. But anyway, the decision was, let's set up a place where you can come and we can talk. The people can see it and know that you're talking to God. And let's take it from there. But like I say, this was not the tabernacle. Now, Exodus 33, verse 5. For Moses had said to God, "Say to the children of Israel, you are a stiff-necked people. I could come up into the midst in one moment and consume you." Say, God says, I want you to give this message to the people. In one moment, I can consume you all. Now, if I stood here and said, I've got a message from God, and what he says is, in one moment, he can consume every single one of you. And I started naming names of the ones he can, you know. That would make you feel a little bit nervous, although you'd know that I'd lost my mind probably. But you know, those people were seeing what God could do. And so, yeah, you'd think they were a little bit nervous maybe. Okay, Exodus 33, verses 12 through 15. The discussion of the tabernacle in the tabernacle meeting. So he's down in this temporary tabernacle now, and he's having this discussion. And Moses says to the Lord, "See, you say to me, 'Bring up this people,' but you have not let me know whom you will send with me. Yet you have said, 'I know you by name. You have found grace in my sight.' Now, therefore, I pray, if I have found grace in your sight, show me now your way, that I may know that you may know you. And that I may find grace in your sight, and consider that this nation is your people." And he said, "My presence will go with you, and I will give you rest." Then he said to him, "If your presence does not go with us, do not bring us up here." Now, you get the impression here, in reading this passage, that Moses' perspective of God is an individual who maybe was setting this thing up, but then he was going to take off and then put somebody, some angel, something in charge. And Moses is saying, "Look, you and I have been dealing with each other. Is this going to continue? How's this going to work? Is this going to continue to work out? If it's not going to be you, just leave us here to die, because I don't think it'll work any other way." He didn't want a substitute leading. You know, he was still learning what indeed the great God was. So, Exodus 33, verses 16 through 21, for how then will it be known that your people and I have found grace in your sight, except you go with us? So we shall be separate, your people and I, from all the people who are upon the face of the earth. So the Lord said to Moses, "I will also do this thing that you have spoken, for you have found grace in my sight, and I know you by name." And he said, "Please show me your glory." And so he said, "Okay, well, don't worry, I'll be there with you the whole way." And then Moses says, "I want to see you. I want to see you." And he said, I will make my goodness, all my goodness pass before you, and I will proclaim the name of the Lord before you. I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion." But he said, "You cannot see my face, for no man shall see me and live." And the Lord said, "Here is a place by me, and you shall stand on the rock." Okay, so he lays this out. But it doesn't happen quite at this moment. Exodus 33, verses 22 through 23. He continues on, "So it shall be, while my glory passes by, that I will put you in a cleft of the rock and will cover you with my hand while I pass, and then I will take away my hand, and you shall see my back, but my face shall not be seen." And then Exodus 34, verses 1 through 2, his ninth time up the mountain. Ninth time up the mountain now. And the Lord said to Moses, "Cut two tablets of stone like the first ones, and I will write on these tablets the words that were on the first tablets, which you broke. So be ready in the morning and come up to in the morning to Mount Sinai and present yourself to me there on the top of the mountain." Okay, so up he goes again to get the new tablets. So that's the main purpose here of why he's going up. Exodus 34, 5 through 6. At this point is when God shows himself to Moses. Now the Lord descended in the cloud and stood with him and proclaimed the name. That's what he said, I will proclaim the name of the Lord. And he proclaimed the name of the Lord. And the Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord God, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abounding in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, by no means clearing the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation. And so he's making a point. So Moses sees the backside, you know, a glimpse. A little bit of a glimpse there. And God makes this statement here about things being passed on to future generations. Now, in Exodus 20, verse 5 and 6, Ten Commandments, Second Commandment, you shall not bow down to them nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations of those that hate me, but showing mercy to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. So he's repeating this idea. I think the, is it Progressive Insurance that stole this idea about the fathers and children and, you know, you are your parents. Have you seen those commercials? You are your parents. And they have all these things that they want to do that their parents did. Said, no, you don't have to tell the waiter your name or whatever, you know. And so this idea that you are your parents, yeah. You know, what you see in your parents, so much of it has passed right on down to you. And if you're taught wrong, you're probably going to suffer for not being taught correctly. And as God makes clear, everybody's independent, but the influences can be pretty strong. That's the point that's being made here. And same thing in Leviticus 26, the verse, one of the chapters on the blessings and cursings. But if they confess their iniquity and the iniquity of their fathers with their unfaithfulness in which they were unfaithful to me, and that they also have walked contrary to me, and that I have also walked contrary to them, and have brought them into the land of their enemies, if their uncircumcised hearts are humbled and they accept their gift, then I will remember my covenant with Jacob, and my covenant with Isaac, and my covenant with Abraham, I will remember. Now notice what he says here. He says you have to repent. But he says a little bit more than that. He says, you need to realize here that I also have walked contrary to you. I've left you. In other words, I've stepped back. And I'm not blessing you the way I'm blessing people who obey, who have accepted me. He said, you've got to understand, you've got to read the signs. Now, if you see, as a nation, speaking of Israel, or speaking of spiritual Israel today, if you see that things just aren't working right, you have to consider the possibility that God may have stepped back because of you. And you've got to recognize what's going on, or you may not repent of all the things that you need to see in yourself and repent of. So he's making a pretty strong point here. And that's just, you know, one passage here in the blessing and cursings chapter of Leviticus 26. But look at Jeremiah 32, verses 18 and 19. You show loving kindness to thousands and repay the iniquity of the fathers into the bosom of their children after them. The great, the mighty God, whose name is the Lord of hosts, you are great in counsel and mighty in work, for your eyes are open to all the ways of the sons of men, to give everyone according to their ways, according to the fruit of their doings. Now, see, this just keeps being emphasized to the Israelites right on through until there is no ancient Israel anymore. So, Jeremiah 32, verses 20 through 22, You have set signs and wonders. Now here, Jeremiah is going back to the time we're talking about, when they were on the Exodus. You have set signs and wonders in the land of Egypt to this day, and in Israel and among other men, and you have made yourself a name. As it is this day, you have brought your people, Israel, out of the land of Egypt with signs and wonders, with a strong hand, an outstretched arm, with great and great terror. You have given them this land of which you swore to their fathers to give them, a land flowing with milk and honey. And they came in and took possession of it, and they have not obeyed your voice or walked in your law. They have done nothing of all that you have commanded them to do. Therefore, you have caused all this calamity to come on them. And they never saw it. They never figured that out, that they were the problem. Okay, so then we get over to Exodus 34. We have the renewal of the covenant. Exodus 34, verses 10 through 27. I'm not going to read all that, but just outline it. God says, here's the deal. He says, I will first do an awesome thing for Israel. Second, enlarge your borders. Third, drive out the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. This is the deal. If Israel will make no covenants with the inhabitants and destroy their sanctuaries, have nothing to do with pagan gods, don't intermarry, make no idols for yourself, keep the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the firstborn of gods are firstborn are gods unless redeemed. Now it turns out that the tribe of Levi became the redeemed. Instead of taking the firstborn of every tribe, he said, I'll just take one tribe. I'll take Levi. That'd be the priest and serve me. Keep the Sabbath and the three holiday seasons and make proper sacrifices. So he keeps laying this out. He keeps laying this out over and over again. And, you know, what do they do? The same old things. They just don't seem to get it. So Exodus 34, verse 27 and 28, then the Lord said to Moses, write these words, for according to the tenor of these words, I have made a covenant with you and with Israel. And so he was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. He neither ate bread nor drank water, and he wrote the tablets, the word of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. Okay, so he gets all this, he gets it all again and brings it back down. We see in Leviticus 1, verses 1 and 2 here. This is an interesting chapter because of the first verse and right at the end. Leviticus 1, verse 1 and 2. Now the Lord called to Moses and spoke to him from the tabernacle of meeting, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them. All right, so now he's in that temporary tabernacle. The Lord calls him, says, speak to the children of Israel. And there's the whole book of Leviticus is what he wants to give. Now, in the end, Leviticus 27, verse 34, these are the commandments which the Lord commanded Moses for the children of Israel on Mount Sinai. So he must have got them up on Mount Sinai, but he didn't deliver it all until later on when God told him to back down in that temporary tabernacle where he would come and talk to God. But they were eventually delivered. Now, what I'm getting at here is a lot of time has passed. 40 days once up in the mountain one time, another 40 days. You know, we're talking about close to 3 months right there. So a lot of time is passing here. Now, and we don't get much in the way of a schedule. But then there's the tabernacle. You know, the tabernacle as opposed to this temporary tent. The tabernacle and, of course, the ark and all the furnishings and everything else that goes with it. Now, this is found in Exodus 25, verses 1 through 11. Now, if you're reading, just saying, okay, Exodus is just an historical account, well, this happened not long after the Ten Commandments were given. But it, the way it reads, it appears that he started talking about it and explained it all the way to the end. But it was very late that the Ark of the Covenant, or the tabernacle and the Ark and all the furnishings and so forth, were actually erected, put up, and first used. Exodus 25, verses 1 through 11. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel, that they might bring me an offering from everyone who gives it willingly, with the heart, with the heart you shall take my offering. And this is the offering which you shall take from them: gold, silver, bronze, blue, purple, and scarlet thread, fine linen, goat's hair, ram skins dyed red, badger skins, acacia wood, oil for the light, spices for anointing oil, and for the sweet incense, onyx stones and stones to be set in the ephod, in the breastplate. And let them make me a sanctuary, that I may dwell among them, according to all that I show you." Then, that is the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of all its furnishings. "Just so you shall make it. And they shall make an ark of acacia wood, 2.5 cubits shall be its length, 1.5 cubits its width, and 1.5 cubits its height. And you shall overlay it with pure gold inside and out." And then it goes on for about 5 chapters describing all the details of this tabernacle. So, so this information was given out pretty early, it seems, but it didn't happen for a long time while the Israelites were there. And some questions come up here. Some are fairly simple to answer, but for example, where did the Israelites, slaves, get all the wealth? Where did all that come from? Well, they did spoil the Egyptians. The Egyptians were ready to do anything to get rid of this plague of Israelites. And so they gave them that kind of stuff. And suddenly, the Israelite slaves were wealthy, and they took that out. But another question is, why a tabernacle? What's wrong with the tent they were using? Why this fancy tabernacle, the ark, and all these things? Particularly, why the ark? Didn't God say not to have any idols? Wouldn't you be likely to worship an idol? That tabernacle, the ark itself. It seems they never did. They worshiped stone, they worshiped this, they worshiped that. But it seems they never took the ark as something to worship, which is kind of strange. Yeah, this is one of the drawings of what the ark might have looked like. I kind of like this one from the viewpoint that it has the proportions right. My Bible says a cubit is about 18 inches. And so the length of this box, this ark, was a little less than 4 feet, and the width and height were the same, about a little more than 2 feet both ways. And I don't know that the angels look remotely like what they've shown here. That's something different, but it's a good proportion for probably what the tabernacle looked like. But they never worshipped it. It carried the tablets, and it carried other symbols. Some manna was in there and some different things, Moses's or Aaron's rod, some things like that. But it was never viewed that way. But it was made clear, be very careful. You don't touch that thing. And so it was a representation of the power of God, but not something people felt like they had to worship. But it was there, and of course, from that point on, once it was there, it led the children of Israel when they went into battle and so forth, and they became very, very aware of what the power was of this ark. But now look at Exodus 40, verses 1 through 3. This is after he's finished describing all the stuff about how to construct the tabernacle, the curtains, the walls, and everything else. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, on the first day of the first month you shall set up the tabernacle of the tent of meeting. You shall put in it the ark of the testimony and partition off the ark as well as the veil. In the first month you shall do this. Well, they didn't get to Sinai till the third month. So now we're talking about year two, a year later from when they left Israel. And then if you look at, so we're talking about 15 days less than 1 year since leaving Egypt. Did I say left Israel? Since leaving Egypt. So we're just about a year here. And if you look at Exodus 40, verses 13 through 15, you shall put the holy garments on Aaron and anoint him and consecrate him that he may minister to me as priest, and you shall bring his sons and clothe them with tunics, and you shall anoint them as you anointed their father. And then skipping down to verse 17, and it came to pass on the first month of the second year, on the first day of the month, that the tabernacle was raised up. So the first day of the first month, the beginning of the year, that's when the tabernacle was finally put together. Now, how long would that, did it take them that long to make all the stuff? I doubt it. It probably was a problem of God said, you're not ready for this yet, because of all these other problems that they were dealing with there. But, you know, we're getting now a year out of Egypt, and they're still stuck at the mountain, you might say. They would kind of like to probably have moved on by now. Numbers 9, verses 1 through 3. Now the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai in the first month of the second year, after they had come out of the land of Egypt, saying, let the children of Israel keep the Passover at its appointed time. On the 14th day of this month, at twilight, you shall keep it at its appointed time, according to all the rites and ceremonies you shall keep it. All right, so now they're up, going to keep the Passover in year two after they left Egypt. Now, when they keep the Passover, that'll be exactly, pretty much, minus a day or so from when they left, minus a day from when they left Egypt, 1 year almost to the day that they left Egypt, they kept the Passover. And then in Numbers 1, verses 1 through 2, now the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai in the tabernacle of meeting on the first day of the second month, in the second year after they had come out of the land of Egypt, saying, take a census of all the congregation of Israel. All right, so now we're a year and 15 days out of Egypt. A census is being taken. A census of those 20 and of who can fight, who are strong and able. All right, so things are beginning to happen here. But what happened in between? You know, we're a month or so, 40 days, another 40 days, say about 3 months. Now we're 9 months from when they got to, or maybe a little more, from when they got to Sinai. What happened during all that time? I mean, they had manna, they had water. What were they doing? And so the preparations then were to leave Sinai, and I'll just outline this. Instead of the firstborn, the Levites were to serve God, Numbers 3, 40 through 51. Tabernacle assignments for the Levite families, Numbers 1, 1 through 33. So begin to really organize things. The Levites had certain duties with the tabernacle, certain ones responsible for different parts, the outer part, the inner parts, and so forth. So all that was laid out. The census of Levites, they took a census of those 30 to 50. There were 8,580, according to Numbers 4, verse 48. It was told to keep lepers outside the camp, Numbers 5, verses 1 through 4. There were rules for restitution of sin, Numbers 5, 5 through 10. Dealing with a spirit of jealousy for a man and his wife, Numbers 5, 11 through 31. Yeah, you start looking at some of these things. It seems like they had some time on their hands. God had to say, okay, it's time to leave. Nazarite vow, number 6, 1 through 21. Offerings for the dedication of the altar, that's whole chapter number 7. Consecration of Levites to serve in the tabernacle, that's numbers 8. He gave rules for taking the second Passover, numbers 9, 6 through 14. We still use those rules today. And then he gave the cloud rules, numbers 9 through 15. Yeah, they had the cloud back then. But it simply was explaining when the cloud moves, you move. When the cloud stops, you stop and set up the tabernacle. So that's basically what he was saying there. And then rules for blowing of the two silver trumpets, in numbers 10, 1 through 10. And then, after reviewing all that, they left. They finally left the mountain of God. Numbers 10, verses 11 through 12. Now it came to pass on the 20th day of the second month in the second year that the cloud was taken up from the tabernacle of testimony, and the children of Israel set out from the wilderness of Sinai on their journeys. They finally did. They finally left 1 year, 1 month, and 5 days after leaving Egypt. Long time they spent there, but it was going to get a lot longer, wasn't it? I've gave you this this summary of the calendar before, from when they Passover or first day of unleavened bread, when they left Egypt, 115 of the first year, going down the seventh Sabbath, finally to Pentecost, and then we don't get much in the way of dates. Matter of fact, let me at this point. There's a pretty big gap in time, you know, from about 9 month gap that we don't know the order of things. So I've kind of put it together as what seemed logical, but it, you know, I could be off a little bit on the order of things that I gave here. But then you can see things picked up, and God specifically gave us some time frames for all of these things. And then he ended up, as we were getting ready to leave, he gave, said how the ministry, in this case the priesthood, how the ministry should bless the children of Israel. And that was in Numbers 6, verses 22 through 27. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron and to his sons, saying, this is the way you shall bless the children of Israel. And then he gave up what the blessing should be. And you know, it's been a pretty rough year. And I'm a minister, so I think it's my province to say the blessing on this church and this congregation. So bow your heads and I'll repeat that blessing. The Lord shall bless you and keep you. The Lord shall make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord shall lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. Amen.